Drilling fluids touch just about everything in the drilling process. We're here to deconstruct the drilling process and drilling fluid concepts to provide a deeper understanding of our industry. In each episode, we'll share information, talk to interesting people, and maybe share a few stories along the way. Welcome to The Flow Line, a production of AES Drilling Fluids, brought to you by Matt Offenbacher and Justin Gauthier.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Flow Line. Matt, it is somewhat springtime. How in the world was your Easter? Tell me about your Easter egg hunt. Surely you had one.
Or you mean one or five?
Okay.
So Archer will be two here in a couple of weeks. Elijah's five. And so five-year-old's all about it, right? And what I've noticed, so we did, he had one at his Spanish immersion school.
Nice.
We did one at Rice University, had one.
Yeah.
And then we had one at church, and then we had one in the backyard that my in-laws put together. So we had four.
That's pretty impressive.
Archer, the two-year-old's still picking up on these things.
Yeah.
Mostly he just opens up the eggs and then throws them on the ground if there's not candy in them. And there was a very strong theme of like less candy, which is what we were afraid of going to all these hunts is like,
yeah,
I don't need a whole sack of Jolly Ranchers or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyways, they're pretty good about that. A lot of weird like fidget spinners and not weird, but like little things that kids like.
Just rinky
so,
things. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. That's good. I share the same sort of thought around the candy situation. So, Well, partially. We had one at our house and we made, I would say like one out of every five had like a little Hershey's thing in there. Whereas like historically it's been like all candy.
Uh-huh.
And then we were like, no, we're not doing that. This is insane. We just went to the dentist like 4 days ago. Unfortunately, everything's good, but it's like, oh, well.
You wanted to stay that way.
Exactly. And then, but we did do one at, we got invited to Second Baptist Church on Saturday, which was a great service. And then of course they had like, which seemed like 14 football fields worth of egg hunting.
I bet.
And they did it by age and grade and stuff. And so it was like, you know, well sought out. And, you know, it's funny. It reminds us like you tell kids to go get eggs and like they can pick up 800 eggs in a matter of 4 minutes. But you tell them to go clean up the room and it takes 4 days.
Right.
It's just like, I know you got it in you.
Yeah.
And so like, just go. But with that being said, it was fun. But the one at Seven Baptist Church was all candy. So, and of course, it's like, yeah, it was just like trying to figure out how to create the boundaries around that. But anyway, it was fun. Easter was great.
We're both kids on board. Like, here's the thing. So Archer is just like, I don't get it. Elijah's all over it. We're both your kids. Like,
yeah, 8 and 5. Right. And then so my son, same thing goes through all. Like, so the one that we did at our house, we had whether it was like stickers or little poppets or same thing, just like little trinket stuff. And he would literally just be tearing eggs, boom, stickers, throw it, boom, this, throw it, and then boom, chocolate, rip it open, eat it. Like he was on a, just like extremely dedicated to finding the chocolate in the eggs. Anyway, I thought that was pretty funny. But either way, it was good. Resurrection time is always a good time of the year.
Yes, I hope everyone who celebrates had a great weekend. I hope you had a great weekend whether you celebrate or not. But if you did celebrate, I hope it was special. It certainly was for us.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know what else is special?
Please lay this segue down on me because I can't wait.
I have to say, water-based mud is often special. It's not often used as much as it was maybe historically, but at the end of the day, when we go to drill, especially on surface, 99.9% of the time, we're drilling water-based mud. However, I think, you know, something you and I had talked about, and it'd be cool to do a deep dive in a series on water-based mud, and each episode will be a different segment, breaking down the different components, different whether it's the products or obviously a number of different things. Matt, why don't you give a little bit of insight or sort of supplement that by explaining what sort of the intent is by doing these series of different episodes?
I mean, I just think it would be cool, you know, when we want to educate and we're obviously, we talk about problems and look, we may not do this linearly, I guess, but I think it would be cool if we had a series of episodes where it's like, you want to know about water-based mud? Listen to these 10 episodes.
Yeah.
And you'll have a good understanding of pretty much every key component and function, and you'll sort of be able to bundle those together to have a pretty good deep dive into what makes water-based mud, water-based mud. And so in light of that, it was like, okay, well, let's just go through the components and then, you know, we'll probably do oil-based mud next.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
Well, with that said, whenever you decide to drill with water-based mud, there's one thing, Matt, pop quiz.
What?
What's the one thing that you absolutely need? Or for the folks out there, take time. What's the one thing you absolutely need when drilling with water-based mud?
Oil. No?
Oh, so close, yeah, man. Okay, the other one.
The other one, water. Right. Yeah.
So I was trying to be funny, but probably wasn't. Anyway, let's talk about the base. Let's talk about the base fluid. The one thing is that makes up pretty much the entire system. So let's start with that, Matt. What is the base fluid for a water-based mud?
Well, here's the thing. It's water, but there could be a lot of other stuff in your water that is, it could be a brine system. It could be, so like, I thought, let's not just run through, okay, when we say water-based, we mean aqueous, water continuous, but that doesn't necessarily mean like, yes, you could drill with just fresh water, but what we're trying to say is like, look, that's a pretty broad brush. So let's talk about all of the brines and anything that could go as your base fluid for a water-based mud, including but not limited to fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so think about like any water-based mud as we discuss, and this includes direct emulsions, right? Which we get this kind of, so direct emulsion, we use those a lot in West Texas, New Mexico, right? It's oil droplets dispersed amongst the water. And so people are saying, oh, you know, that means it's inhibitive because it's got oil in it. It's like, well, the formation still sees all that water. So water continuous, water-based mud. And I mean, we can like this stuff because it's cheap, because it can be cheap. If you want an expensive one, we can talk about those. But like other things we like, environmental compatibility. It's one reason your spud mud is going to be water-based is it's pretty benign. So you can drill through the water table, get that cased and sealed off safely and securely because water-based mud is pretty cheap and harmless, you know, in that capacity. But it does have the disadvantage of being interactive with the formation because it's water continuous. It can cause clays to swell. It can cause other sort of things to, you know, basically wet the rock. Higher fluid loss, which may be a stuck pipe risk. You know, there's a few other things you have to, you know, think about. And we have episodes on how you choose one versus the other. And, you know, the short answer is it depends.
Right.
But you got to think about the big picture. But once you've decided, you know, you can start with something as basic as just fresh water, you know, well water, what have you.
Right. But not all fresh water is created equal, is it?
Yeah. I mean, so there's a lot of times like, oh yeah, man, we got a great well right over here. Water, you know, water's next to nothing. The landowner's letting us use the well, whatever. But it may not be that fresh.
Mm.
It may have some bugs in it, which would require a biocide.
Mm-hmm.
It may have a lot of, it may be very hard water, which means you may need to treat it if you want some of your products to work.
Yeah.
You know, there could be other stuff in there, you know, going back to the bugs, could be sour, could have, you know, H2S or what have you. So fresh water, even when they're like, oh, we got some great well water, it's worth checking because it may have some stuff in there where you start adding product and you're like, what's going on? My mud's not yielding. And it's like, oh,
right.
We got to treat this stuff out before we can get going.
Pro tip. Whenever you're getting water on location, always test it.
Right.
Especially if it's coming from another pond or somewhere else. So, hey, we got another source of water. Don't worry, it's fresh water. You can use it for makeup water, drill water, whatever. Always test it.
Right. And the reason we know this so well is because I am sure both of us have had that head scratcher where we're looking, we're like, I've added way too much material to see this little. And then it's like, oh, and then you felt like a moron. We've all been there. It was a long time ago though, right? I mean, we've matured since then.
Yeah.
However, in our younger years, we learned the hard way, and we will never forget that never assume that your makeup water is what anybody tells you it is.
Right. So
check.
So I'm going to ask a simple question, but I think it's important maybe for some mud engineers who are fairly new. If you get some water onto location, what are you testing? Like, what are like the main tests you should do if you're going to check your makeup water?
I mean, the first thing I would do is check hardness, right? Because that's going to be, you know, if you've got a bunch of calcium, magnesium in there, whatever, that's going to be a disruptor to a lot of your products. So the great thing is in your mud kit, you can do that titration. No problem. You go ahead and check for chlorides just to see, you know, is this stuff really actually kind of brackish or is it fresh water? So I would basically kind of run through those basic titrations. I check the pH just in case something's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes particularly hard water will be more alkaline. So just know what you're up against. And even, you know, if you have a mixer handier or even like if you're making up a polymer mud or something like that, it's pretty easy to tell, like throw some of it in a jar and just see if a little bit of it does anything.
Right.
And then start with a pit and like, okay, is it doing what I thought it would? Or do I need to go back? Like if you try and mix the whole system at once and something is wrong, you've cut a lot of sacks And it's like, okay, maybe we could have made this a lot easier on ourselves way earlier on.
Yeah. So, and to, you know, and again, some will probably laugh, but if you get in and you're in a, if you're tight for time, you could always run a mud weight. And if it checks out at 8.3, then you know it's not brine.
Right.
So that's like a quick and dirty. If like you're, again, in a bind, you're losing returns. It's like, oh, we got this new source of water. You don't want to start dumping 10 pound brine by accident when you're losing at like 9 pounds.
Yeah, well,
mixing that with your fresh water-based mud system.
Yeah, and let's keep in mind, we find a lot of residual stuff too, right? Like, you can get a lot of really nasty stuff from vac trucks that weren't cleaned properly, and very often, no matter what, even if you ask, I had it steam cleaned. It's like, no, you didn't. so, like, just proceed with caution there, and you know, to Justin's point, anything that's coming off, if you can check it before it ends up getting in your system, even those little basic things can catch some gotchas. Cause it could have been like it was half filled with brine and then they like threw some water on top of it. Like, it looks like water to me.
Yep.
So yes, another good point is a mud weight can quickly give you a little bit of an indication. So we've kind of gone through some of that, but you can actually use salt to your benefit or use salt on purpose for a few different things. And sometimes it's just using things that are salty for free, like, let's say, seawater or produced water. And so we'll kind of break down some of the brines you might use or the salts you might use as makeup fluids.
Perfect. Yeah, there's a few that come to mind. I mean, because obviously here on land, you're either using produced brine or or sodium chloride brine from somewheres. But I know there's quite a few more, Matt. So why don't you dive through the different types of brines?
Yeah. So, I mean, first we'll say like seawater, if you're working offshore, it's free, right? So like people are a big fan of that. Most places where you are, you'll want to check those chlorides. If you're near like a tidal water area, sometimes depending on when you pulled the water during the day, it will have a different salinity.
Right.
You know, I've encountered this, you know, it's like everybody sort of knows if you're pretty far offshore, like Gulf of Mexico is about 35,000 milligrams per liter chlorides, like standard, right? Another great way to tell if the ship captain, when you're transporting whole mud, ballasted his tanks with seawater and pumped it into your mud tank during transportation is whether those chlorides go up or down. Mm. And doing the basic like volumetric conversions of if I gained this many barrels relative to when I strapped it, when it left, and then the chlorides dropped by X amount or changed by this amount, it's 35,000 milligrams per liter. I can tell you how much seawater I took probably.
Yeah.
But anyways, seawater is a cheap base fluid. It's great for like drilling out and that kind of thing. The challenge there, of course, is it's going to have some of that hardness. It's going to have not only does it have salinity, but it's going to have magnesium, calcium in small amounts, but amounts that either have to be dealt with. So you may have to like prehydrate products, you know, give it a lot of extra time, which you may or may not have. You have to think in advance.
Right.
Or you might cut it with fresh water, right? You only have so much what we call drill water. You mix the two together to cut the chlorides down a little bit. It plays a little nicer with your products. But we like seawater because it's free, but it's only going to give you a density of about 8.5 if we're going for a solids-free density.
Mm-hmm.
Produced water can be, I mean, the problem with produced water is produced water can be just about anything. And we've kind of talked about this in the past because we'd love to be able to reuse it. There's so much of it going around.
Right.
But it's very, very difficult to predict what's going to be in there. And so sometimes there's some pretty nasty stuff in there that doesn't play nice with mud products and basically will undermine whatever you're trying to mix. You know, right. Even if you're just drilling with produced water, a lot of basic additives, you could be surprised too. It's consistently inconsistent and it's very difficult at the rig site to know, am I getting produced water from the same place? I'm like, no, you're getting produced water and I have no idea what's in it. So, you know, there, a lot of salt, a lot of strange cations sometimes that can really wreak havoc on other products. But then we get into kind of, I don't know if you call it the more normal stuff, but like sodium chloride brine, we use that all the time, right?
Yeah.
And sodium chloride brine, you know, we like it. It's monovalent, which, you know, Na plus one, that tends to play very nicely with a lot of our products, our xanthan gum or what have you, if we need to increase the mud weight. It's compatible with most of our products. It's cheap. You can get it a lot of places. Sometimes it can have a little calcium in there too, so you got to check for that. We've definitely seen, you know, sodium chloride should saturate out at about 10 pounds per gallon. Sometimes we'll get, you know, some is like 10 too, and the rest of that is probably calcium. So worth keeping in mind, but we can drill a lot with that. Potassium chloride, normally this stuff's getting really, really a lot more expensive. But potassium is a great shale inhibitor. So a lot of people like to have a little bit of KCl in there. Not cheap, but definitely helpful as an inhibitor. You know, worth keeping in mind that if you mix KCl with sodium chloride, like their ionic radius is kind of similar. And so sodium chloride can sort of disrupt that inhibitive mechanism. You have to keep a certain rate. You got to have more potassium to outbalance that.
Gotcha.
But saturated rate about 9.7. So you're not going to spend a ton of money on this stuff when you get 10 pounds sodium chloride for cheap.
Right.
If you're just looking for density. Sodium bromide. So now we're getting kind of exotic here, right? And I'm just going down my list in no particular order. So sodium bromide saturates out at about 12.5 under typical conditions. And the stuff's compatible with everything, you know, that sodium monovalent. Good stuff. Very expensive.
Okay.
And those bromides, not cheap. And then we get into like fancier stuff. We get into the formates. Okay. So you've got sodium, potassium, and cesium formate. Well, sodium formate isn't that expensive, but it's still expensive for the oil field,
right.
I'd say, or at least for unconventionals.
Yeah.
And it only gets you to about like 11.1, I think, on clear fluid mud weight. Potassium formate gets you about 13.1, but it's that potassium and it's formate, so it's quite expensive, you know, several hundred dollars a barrel.
Mm,
right? And then cesium formate, if that sounded expensive, you know, cesium formate is very, very expensive. There's very few sources of it. You sort of rent it. You don't buy it. There's just not a lot of it to go around. It can be $20,000 a barrel. You know, I don't know what a real quote is. Talk to your supplier if you want to know.
Yeah.
But it's very expensive. There's a lot of money in reusing it and recycling it because it costs so much in the first place.
Yeah.
But the formates are nice because they work with things like xanthan gum and that sort of thing. They're, you know, they work with your traditional products for the most part. They're buffered. So like they're not, you know, corrosion isn't as much of an issue. They're very inhibitive, but I wouldn't go after potassium formate just for those reasons. I'd go after it because I need it I can't have chlorides in it, for example, or blah, 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 you know, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get into some of our divalents. So calcium chloride's reasonably cheap, right? Gets us up to 11.6. You know, our Canadian brethren to the north use it quite a lot. But the challenge there is those cations, you know, that calcium only plays nice with certain things. So while I can get a higher solids free density, I've got to contend with that along with these other ones. Keep in mind, you can't run the pH very high because the calcium will come out of solution, right? It'll precipitate.
Oh, okay.
So calcium bromide, we're back in the, you know, bromide territory, but calcium bromide will get you 14.2, pretty heavy. Kind of nice. Zinc bromide will get you to 19.2. Very, very low pH. I mean, that's, you know, kind of like battery acid. It's got zinc, which is a heavy metal, right? So it's a marine hazard. You've got to use precautions. If you're using it offshore, you'd use precautions everywhere. But it's got another environmental factor to it. And then the other interesting point I will add for everybody's personal benefit, an interesting thing, if you have a bromide system, that actually titrates like chlorides, which can be good and bad. Because if you have any chlorides in there, they're going to show up as bromides, but vice versa, right? So if you have a mixed salt system, it's kind of like trying to do chlorides for sodium and calcium chloride. You need to do the two salt titration.
Yeah.
But it's pretty tricky to tell the difference between chlorides and bromides without some fancy stuff. So all that being said, those are kind of your whole slew of brine options, many of which we are very unlikely to use just simply due to cost. We would love to, you know, cation compatible materials are out there. They just cost a bit too, right?
Right.
So.
Okay. So beyond the just the base fluid itself, the brine, talk a little bit about the native pH.
So, I was alluding to earlier, like the calcium stuff, the zincs, like they have to have a lower pH. If you raise the pH, these salt, metal salts are going to come out of solution.
Mm.
So that, you know, you've got to think of different ways to address corrosion.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a nastier complication. The formates, you don't have to worry about that as much. As I mentioned, they're already natively buffered. And that's, frankly, I mean, they're made from formic acid, which they have to be buffered because if they weren't and they fell apart, you would have acid plus your other constituents.
Right.
But they're buffered, so like that shouldn't really be a problem. You know, and then you've got the sodium bromide chloride, the potassium chloride. Like those are your sort of normal actors, right? You can carry the pH up, you know, a bit higher without having, you know, your normal oil field kind of ranges. A few other things to think about. A lot of people think about corrosion and that sort of thing. Saturated brines allow less dissolved oxygen, which means they're actually less corrosive. But moderate, like brackish salinity, is actually where you get into that corrosion problem most of the time.
Okay.
I mentioned the cations, the calcium and stuff, just not playing nice with things. But generally, when we go through this whole slew, a lot of times we're looking for solids-free density because solids-free, you know, clear fluids drill really fast, all that good stuff. But, you know, if you're looking for inhibition, you know, that potassium ion, those calcium ions can be very helpful, which may be why you would include them on purpose. You know, a few other things to think about as I go through the list. So TCT and PCT, which we've talked about, true crystallization temperature and pressure crystallization temperature. We won't worry so much about PCT, but think of it as same thing as pressure. Or I'm going to go back. I'm just going to talk about TCT first and then express it in terms of PCT. So if you think about it, when something's hot, more stuff goes into solution, right? Mm-hmm. So when I say that like sodium bromide is a 12.5, I'm talking about typical like 74 degrees, you know, temperature. Okay. But if it were to get colder, there'd be a temperature that, depending on how much salt is there, salt would start to fall out, right? We don't want that to happen. That would be a bad thing if we're using it for density. If I heat it up, more stuff is soluble, right? And there's sort of a curve where on one side of it, you actually generate salt crystals as you're near saturation. On the other side of it, your ice forms, right? Like water freezes at 32F. If you had some salt, it's going to freeze at a lower temperature, right? So knowing those, where you stand on that curve, and so like sodium chloride, when, you know, when we have really cold weather, everybody's like, what's going to happen to my brine in this tank? And it's like, well, the salt's going to come out of it if you're saturated, right? Yeah. Or it's not going to freeze because it's only going to get so cold. But, you know, you think about it, things go into solution better when they're hot and less so when they're cold. Now apply pressure, give it less unit volume for the amount of salt to dissolve into it, right?
Yeah.
So this is more offshore. You think about like testing your BOPs and you have this stuff in the hole, right? So now you put 10,000 PSI of pressure on it, and it's cold, it may want to precipitate out.
Yeah.
Bad news, right? So we don't do that. And then there's other stuff to think about, right? Like some of these salts don't play nice with others, so they can precipitate out. They might not work with other products. Sometimes it's really hard to keep track of, let's say you just start blending stuff together, you might not know exactly what you have. And so brines are complicated. I think that's the message, really. Does that sound right?
Yeah. No, there's, I mean, again, I figured when we first started talking about this, I was like, oh, we'll rip through this. But now when we talk about the different water-based fluids, you know, again, the freshwater piece is fairly simple. But the brine thing is interesting because there's so many, there's a lot of variations. They each have their own complications on how you use them, and they all have their own limitations, their own densities. And so we've had episodes on brines specifically. So if you were to go back, I don't know exactly what episode, but for the purpose of today, that, you know, when we're talking about water-based muds, you've got the two base fluids, you've got your fresh water, quote unquote, and then you've got your brines. And one thing I'll note too is it's easy to assume that water-based muds are safer. But I highly encourage anyone, I mean, and again, if you're a mud engineer, anyone on a rig working with water-based, oil-based, any drilling fluids, you're always going to have the safety information out there. Mm-hmm. But just because it's a water-based spud mud doesn't mean that you can still drink the stuff, shower in it, and have water fights.
Yeah.
Because there are chemicals in there, and just because it's fresh water doesn't mean it's coming from your tap and bathtub. So, you know, again, I really encourage and strongly emphasize the importance of reading the SDSs, and just because it's water-based mud, if you're drilling with a brine, it can cause all kinds of issues as well.
Yeah, well, and let's, you know, to your point, I think there's an important element of when you start thinking something isn't harmful, you tend to be less cautious.
Right.
We've talked about this with base oils where like a non-diesel oil is used and you're like, oh, it doesn't smell, it's not a weird color. And then you splash it on your coveralls or whatever and like you don't wash up and then you have some kind of chronic skin irritation. Same thing can happen here. Like salt water shouldn't stick on your skin indefinitely. Mm-hmm. And if you're like, oh, I'll wait till tower change to clean up or whatever, you can run the same risk. I mean, it's benign. Even the environmentally friendly stuff is designed to not hurt the water table, but that doesn't mean it should be sitting on your skin all day or any of those things. And so you need to stay informed and not make any assumptions, right? Like you're not supposed to touch this stuff.
Right.
I really think it's important to emphasize that. But there are so many different permutations and combinations of this stuff too, where if you think you know what you're handling, and it might not be what you think you're handling.
Right.
So holistically, like the biggest challenge with water-based mud is there's a billion different kinds. And so we're gonna talk about a number of these permutations and combinations, but I guarantee you at the end of all this, we still won't have covered everything.
That's right? True. And again, with that being said, if anyone out there has experience with just very unique or kind of maybe some exotic water-based fluids, let us know. I mean, again, we're kind of spoiled when it comes to Lower 48, the unconventionals, drilling with mostly, you know, diesel-based invert emulsions. Sometimes we get tricky and drill some water-based mud stuff, but it's not near as complex as what you'd see offshore or some other parts of the world drilling, you know, true high-performance water-based muds with all kind of different polymers and all this kind of unique stuff. But again, it's important and it's part of our day-to-day drilling. Anything else, Matt, that you want to mention?
I think we've covered, you know, we've beaten to death the first thing you would fill your pits with before you started mixing.
Right.
Hopefully that was helpful and insightful, but just consider how much there is to think about if all we've covered is the water that you start with.
Right.
And then we got to cover everything else we're going to throw in there.
Right. And last but not least, again, I'll remind everyone, check your water when you get it to location.
Yes.
Please.
We just saved you hours. You're welcome.
Hopefully time and money.
Yes.
Anyways, folks, again, really appreciate it. If you have any thoughts, questions, concerns, or you just want to provide some feedback, good or bad, please reach out to us on LinkedIn, or you can reach us at the Flowline Podcast at aesfluids.com. Please, if you could, check out the new website. You know, the group did an amazing job of revamping that. So check it out. And again, we've got the YouTube channel, lots of good information on there. And again, we appreciate all the support. And we will catch you later. Be safe.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. Please tune in next week for another exciting episode of The Flowline. And remember, may your returns always be full and your trips always smooth. Views expressed in this program belong to participants and not their employees. The program is for informational purposes only and cannot take the place of seeking professional advice. Copyright AES Drilling Fluids.